and welcome to Minute 21 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1988 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is Lil Eddie O'Hare. Sorry about that.
Yeah, formerly call me Ed, that's fine.
All right. Joining me today is Ed, formerly of the DC TV Report and Wicked Theory of Podcast. Welcome to the show, Ed, Lil Ed.
Happy to be here. How's it going?
It's going great, going great. I'm looking forward to, finding out what happens in the rest of this movie. Who knows? You know, we've had some interesting episodes till now. You know, last week we had a guest that had never seen the movie and only saw those 5 episodes. So, you know, we're back to the point. I hope that you've seen this movie. Have you seen this movie?
Yes, I have seen this movie.
Okay. You've seen it at least once. So we're good.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Right. Yes.
What's your history?
I can tell you it's a very special movie for me because it's obviously the best movie that came out the year I was born, 1988.
So you're saying you didn't see it in the theater in 1988?
No.
You might have seen it. Your parents didn't take you in 1988 to see it? It's possible.
No. My mother, no.
Wait, what month is your birthday?
January.
Oh, okay. All right. Me too. Yeah. So you were at least 6 months old then when it came out, because it came out, debuted July 15th. So, you know, you could have made it in, 6 months, possible. I've been to movies where people bring babies, which can be a very interesting experience. Let's put it that way. Sometimes it's good. Sometimes it's not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I've had that. I've actually been in situations where I was with a group of guys and we had to explain to a mom that her 4-year-old should not be watching Deadpool.
I think that's a good. I that's a good advice. Did she get up and walk out?
No.
Yeah. She's like, screw that. You guys don't know what you're talking about. I want to see Deadpool. Yeah. I don't care. My kid won't understand everything's going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I actually was at a screening of Sin City where a parent was screaming at her child as she was dragging him out of the theater.
Oh, wow.
Why would you read it? But it's based on a comic book.
People need to do a little bit of research before they see movies.
Yep.
Or sorry, let me rephrase that. People need to do a little bit of research before they take their kids to see movies. We all watch movies that we don't do research on beforehand. But if you're an adult, it's not big of a deal.
And sometimes those ratings are there for a reason.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, yeah, that R rating means something.
That's true. I mean, as we know, Planes and Automobiles, it's got an R rating just for 1 minute of the movie. That's it.
Yes.
And this movie, we'll get into it a little bit this week. Obviously, this movie's R because of the violence, but we'll talk about something else that appears later on this week that helped make this movie an R-rated movie. We'll get there. I think we get there on Thursday, Friday, something like that. So, teaser for people to come back if they really want to, hear what Ed and I have to say about that. So what's your history of this movie? When do you remember when the first time you saw it was, since it wasn't when you were still in diapers?
I was probably about 9 or 10, staying over my cousin Pete's house, where we were born a month apart. I think it was somewhere in there. We saw Die Hard with a Vengeance. I can't remember which one I saw first, but just at that point, falling in love with the series and John McClane. Also, I have an uncle who's now retired NYPD detective, but he joined the force in 1990. Also coming from an Irish Catholic family in New York City, I recognize a lot of that same sensibility. And my uncle actually bears a vague resemblance to the way Bruce Willis looks in this movie. He still has all of his hair today.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But
is he a fan of the movie also?
Yes. And it was funny. It wasn't until preparing for this podcast that I actually realized that my uncle does have a lot of the same kind of swagger and mannerisms that John McClane does. Yeah.
Wow. So in other words, you are John McClane's nephew. That's what you're saying.
Sort of.
It's a bit of a stretch. You should call your uncle Uncle John, and that's it. You know.
Yeah, I'll take it.
Yeah. Well, the question is whether he will.
Yes.
That's the question. All right. Well, so minute 21 begins with Eddie coming around the desk and ends with Tony trying to find the right group of wires. All right. Yes. So on Friday, we ended with, them killing the actually, it was on Thursday that they killed the John Larroquette doppelganger who was sitting at the desk. I love referring to him that way, and I'm going to keep referring to the actor that way because every time I've seen this movie, I always think that's John Larroquette, even though I know it's not.
Yeah, I will say that character didn't deserve to die, but he deserved a slap in the face for the way he treated John downstairs, where he makes him go through the directory to find Holly
and to find the place where everybody in there's the only people in the place. No, come on.
Yeah, where everyone is on the same floor.
It's a little bit of a problem, and I think you're right. I think that Rick DeSeti deserved to get shot right between the eyes, or at least the character that Rick DeSeti played. I'm sorry, didn't mean to offend you, Rick. You know, if hopefully you're listening, but if not,
Come on, bro.
Maybe Matt Tiernan told you to play it that way. It's possible. I don't know, but we know that's in the script. So that is the way that things are supposed to play out. So basically that's what happened. Then Theo went to go close down all the elevators in the back room, in the control room. And then, he throws something very strange to Carl, who passes it off to Hans. And then this minute begins with Eddie coming around the desk in order to start putting on the uniform of Rick Sassetti. So I guess it's a good thing they shot him in the head. Because, they didn't get any blood. Somehow they got no blood on the jacket, so it's possible to wear it.
Mm-hmm. Funnily enough, my grandparents, when I was growing up, lived in a townhouse, but there was a high-rise that was part of their complex. I used to go there sometimes to use the gym or the swimming pool, and the doorman there had almost the exact same uniform. It was a light gray suit and vest.
Maybe they worked for the Nakatomi Corporation.
Yeah. Somehow the Nakatomi might have owned the Ocean View Apartments in Staten Island.
It's possible. Why not? That worked. Why not? Come on. We know that Nakatomi is a very wealthy company. They have more than just the Nakatomi building. They definitely have offices in Japan, and we can infer possibly that they have offices in New York, because the assumption that I've made, whether it's correct or not, we'll never know, is that Holly was working for Nakatomi in New York, and they gave her the opportunity because she's a very high-level position here. So she had to be working in some high-level position beforehand in order to get this type of job. So it's possible that it was just a promotion within Nakatomi and that they moved her over, or she was working somewhere else. She wasn't working as a secretary or, as a teacher or something like that. She had some very high profile business job before she moved over to Nakatomi in LA. That we can tell for sure. The question is what type of job, who knows whether it was Nakatomi or not. We'll also never know. But I mean, one of the things that I really like about the way this whole movie is set up, first of all, you see how organized the bad guys are. I mean, Eddie already is wearing the shirt of what a guard would wear. He's got the vest. All he needed was the jacket. The jacket. Yeah. I guess he needed the jacket because it has the emblem of Nakatomi. Which looks like a samurai type of emblem or something like that. That would be the only. You'd think that they would have been even more organized and found a way to get a Nakatomi jacket. But okay, and it's a good thing that both Eddie and Rick Sassetti are the same size.
Yes. Yeah.
Because they're like, okay, we need to get one of the henchmen, and he needs to be the same size as the, as the guard, so that we can make sure that if someone comes and looks, if Al Powell happens to show up later, you know, he's not going to get suspicious that the jacket doesn't fit.
Yeah, that may have been why exactly why he's the guy that ends up there, and then he's not upstairs at the detonators
Right.
with everybody else.
Exactly. For sure. Well, they needed someone at the desk to make sure, to make it seem as if everything is just going, you know, going normal. You know, everyone's partying on Christmas Eve at, I mean, sunset was at 4:50. So this is maybe 6 o'clock. You know, we're not talking about it being very late. You know, it's one of the things that I've noticed a little bit of a pattern between the three movies that I've done so far in The Great Escape, Planes, Trains, Automobiles, and here is that it always seems much later than it really is. You know, things look darker. You know, Planes, Trains, Automobiles, there were scenes that look like take place at 3 o'clock in the morning, and they don't. They take place at eight, you know, when they're stuck on the highway or stuff like that. But whatever. So at this point, you know, Hans walks over to the door of the lobby, and then he looks out in a very intense way, as only, you know, Hans Gruber can do, which, you know, he's great at that. And then he takes the card that he has in his hand and places it on the lock panel, and then swipes it in order to engage the alarm. And he does it in a very swift and suave way. You know, that first he's looking to make sure there's nothing going on.
And that's just enough to get that perfect profile shot, so you really get a sense of who he is, that this is the guy who's in charge.
Yes. Alan Rickman knew what he was doing. This was his first movie that he starred in, because he was only in theater beforehand, but he got it right here. No question about it. He gets the gaze of the whole thing, which is why a lot of people say, myself included, that he's one of the best villains in all of film. You know, there are very few villains that you could say are better than him. You know, 'cause he's a likable villain. You know, he's not a villain that you look at and say, "Oh, I hate that guy." He's like, this is a guy I would love to meet, you know. Even though he's sadistic and murderous and all those things, you know. But whatever. So, I mean, first of all, it's very strange. How does the alarm work here? Like, what would you think? They're locking the door. Okay. Again, it's 6 o'clock at night. There's a party going on in the building. You'd think that the guard would, I mean, the doors are open. When Theo and Carl showed up last week, they didn't need to wait for the guard to come open up the door for them. When John showed up 2 weeks ago, he didn't need to wait for the guard to show up for him. So why? I mean, I understand from the villainous perspective why they want to keep it locked. But on the other hand, they want to keep things looking normal. So why would they lock it?
Well, I mean, it may just be a sense that I mean, I think that's exactly it. They don't want anybody coming in, and they'll have someone at the door so that if they can unlock it just to address somebody, if a cop comes knocking at the door, they could just open it to do it. But they don't want someone just wandering in aimlessly, or if someone's not paying attention, that they could get into the building. They want to control exactly who and when people enter the
Right,
building.
no, I agree with you on that, but I'm looking from the perspective that if they want to be as inconspicuous as possible, so at 6 o'clock at night, locking the door is going to be a little more suspicious. I mean, it's not 2 o'clock in the morning when, okay, there's nobody expected to come in, and therefore it's the guard's job to keep everything locked.
Well, I think they're figuring, I mean, it's not like that alarm is going straight to the police. No one else is going to know that they've engaged the alarm except them,
Right.
you know.
Okay. That's true also. And then he takes the card and throws it to Eddie. Nice throw here. You know, makes it right to Eddie. You know, there's no fumbling along the way. You know, nice arc in the throw. And then Eddie takes it and puts it in the inner left-hand pocket of his jacket. Right. And then you know, we see that right behind Eddie at this point, we see that Theo is still there. You know, he's playing around with like a bag that's right behind there, which.
Yeah, and you see that he's immediately the wisecracking shenanigans and everything are gone, and now that he's with Hans, he's all business,
Yes.
and He's you know, moving straight forward. Randy, he's on assignment now. He doesn't want to look like he's jerking around in front of the boss.
Correct. Exactly. Especially since, you know, they apparently all know who Hans is.
Yes.
You don't mess with Hans. That's what it comes down to. But what I like is that, okay, Eddie brought the bag that Theo is going into. You know, like, again, it's all planned out. You know, Eddie only brings that bag. I mean, I'm assuming he has his stuff in there too, because I think the bag, does the bag stay there or Theo takes the bag with him?
No. He puts it over his shoulder.
He puts it over his shoulder, so he takes it. So whatever, yeah, you know, Eddie needed, he already took out, you know, from there.
Yeah.
So, no, it's just interesting the way that it's all, you know, the little crossing the T's and dotting the I's, you know, along the way of making sure that, okay, this is all completely covered here at this point. And then we see Hans nod over to Theo. Theo then starts walking towards the elevator, and Hans once again looks out into the distance, you know, once again, just trying to figure out, you know, making sure that nobody is coming around, nobody's going to be bothering them. And then we see Hans turn after a few seconds, and then he walks towards the elevator behind Theo. And at this point, we hear that the music starts changing. It goes to a different type of beat, you know. And then at this point, we get to see another one of the bad guys. This one is named Tony. And
yeah,
we'll later on find out who Tony really is, you know. Mm-hmm. And
Tony, played by Andreas Wishnevsky.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. Yes, I'm also a huge James Bond fan, and prior to this, he played Necros in The Living Daylights.
Yeah, he was also in a few of the Mission Impossible movies.
Yes,
you know, he has 21 TV credits and 18 movie credits, so, you know, he doesn't have that many movie credits, and most of them are going to be really, really small roles. You know, he wasn't really a you know, he's not an actor that you're going to find, you know, in too many movies.
Yeah, well, I think most of his stuff is out of Germany.
Could be.
And yeah. And what's interesting here is the part that he played in Living Daylights, he was, you know, the very svelte, you know, they showing off that lean Scandinavian body, that lean German body. And very much like Robert Shaw's character in From Russia with Love, where he got to be the bad guy who used headphone wire as a garrote and threw exploding milk bombs.
Yeah.
and this is a very different turn from him, where he has the glasses and he seems very buttoned up and nerdy.
Right. That's very true. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I like the fact that he's also a dancer. So, you know, he and Carl, played by you know, Alexander Gudinov, they're both dancers, and they cast them both as brothers. You have the dancing brothers. Mm-hmm.
I'd love to see that ballet.
I don't know if I'm really that interested. I'd rather see them here in Die Hard. You know, I don't think so. So we see him. He exits the door, and then he turns and then points to the left. And then, you know, goes to the left and then the right, then the left. I mean, it's great because, you know, he has it memorized where he needs to go. You know, he's been given an assignment that, okay, you got to go to a particular place. And the way to get there is you leave, you go to the right, you go to the left, you go to the right, you know, things like that. And he's like counting it off as he's doing it.
Yeah, you can it almost looks as if you could tell he's never been here before, and he's only looked at these directions on a map, which is why he's sort of, you know, going, okay, here, okay, all right, now I'm where I need to be.
Yeah, and we get an amazing tracking shot, you know, because it follows him as, you know, he's like coming towards the camera, and the camera's moving backwards the entire time with him as he's going, you know, left, then right, then left, and you know, at that point, we see that, you know, it completely just follows him through on the corridor. And then, you know, as he's making his final left, you can see on the side of the wall, you know, he moves into like this small little brick corridor, which in a few seconds we'll find out is actually a stairwell. And there's a sign on the side that says B2, stair 3, no roof access. Okay, which is funny because he's going down. My assumption is he's in the basement.
Yeah.
he's not in, you know, they haven't brought, you know, he's not in the top floor or anything like that. So like, you know, I wonder where the other end of the stairs are that go up. Because if the stairs are going down at this point and the sign says no roof access, so you'd think that there would be stairs that are going up somewhere behind him maybe, but then the sign shouldn't be there.
Well, I think that to me it's just, you know, there are multiple different stairwells in the building.
Yeah, for sure.
But only some of them go up to the roof.
Yeah, but he's going down. Ah, you're saying if someone walks up and then sees that, okay, that could be also. I wasn't thinking from that perspective.
Yeah. It's telling people who are going up that you're not going to get to the roof from here.
Right. Okay.
You got to go to the other side of the building and take the other staircase.
Right. This is B2. Maybe you need to take B1. Who knows? And you might bump into John McClane along the way later this week.
Yeah. I think the floor is basement level 2.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think that's what it is. The floor is basement level 2.
Right. Okay. You know, but, all right. That makes sense also.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I didn't think about that one. I was thinking that it was stairwell. Ah, because it's stairwell number 3. So it's
yes.
Okay. You're right. It's basement level 2. That actually makes a lot of sense. Now, did you look at that the way the sign is on the wall? It looks like it's taped with duct tape. You know, it's not like affixed or anything like that. It's something that you know is looks very temporary.
Well, this depend. Do you know? Was this shot? I'm guessing this was shot at the Fox Plaza.
I doubt it. I doubt it. This looks like this looks like something. I didn't check. I don't really usually go into where things are. You know, I don't do the research as to which shots are on a stage and which shots are real. But this does not look like a real shot. It looks like something they did on a stage, on a sound stage.
Okay,
that's what I would think.
Because I was gonna say I know. The building, Nakatomi Plaza, is actually the Fox Plaza, which is on the Fox lot. And the building was just brand new at the time. Mm-hmm. There was only one floor where the offices were being used. So it may have been that, you know, the building was still kind of under construction and they were just putting the signs there as placeholders until they put the permanent signs. Right.
Yeah, of course, it's possible. But it's just funny that you can see that it's duct tape. You know.
Yes.
So, who knows? What do you know about duct tape?
You
weren't expecting that one, were you, Eddie?
I know. As an Eagle Scout, I know it has very very many uses. I have buddies who used to make wallets out of duct tape.
I actually saw a picture online today of a wallet that was made out of duct tape. That's really cool that you brought that up.
Yeah. Yeah, oddly enough, the one thing that it is not very effective at is taping ducts.
Have you tried? I hope not as a Boy Scout. I hope you didn't get a badge in taping ducts in the attempting to tape ducts.
No, but you usually like air ducts. If there's a lot of heat and pressure, the adhesive tends to melt away. It's great at taping almost everything else.
Right.
Well,
first of all, it's not called duct tape. It's called duct, D-U-C-T.
Yes.
A lot of people do call it duct tape for that very reason. But the reason for that is it's actually made out of. What do you think it's made out of? It's made out of non-adhesive cotton duct cloth. So there is a duck related to it. If it walks like a duck, if it sticks like a duck, you know. Mm-hmm. And I mean, people have been using it since you know, it's listed in the Oxford Dictionary in 1899. So it means that even beforehand, people were using it. But as you said, it's used. It has so many different uses. I mean, I found a list of all the different types of uses that it has been used for. We're not going to go into it because it's a little too much. But the thing I love is the fact that it was used on NASA, used it on every mission.
Yeah.
You know, apparently they once interviewed Charles D. Walker, who was on a space shuttle mission. And he said that they take duct tape on every single mission because it's something that works really well, even in the vacuum of space.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
And it's apparently ever since the Gemini program in the early 60s, every single flight, they always made sure to have duct tape there. And I mean, anyone who's seen Apollo 13 knows that that was actually used in order to help them with the filtration system when they were trying to get the, you know, the carbon dioxide out. So they needed to
Yes.
take duct tape that they had. You know, it wasn't something
Yeah,
that they
that.
just made up. It was something that really, really was done. So it's
Yeah, when they put the guys in the room and said, "This is what we have on the ship," there was a roll of duct
that's
tape
right.
there.
That's right. And apparently the guy who designed the modification, his name was Ed Smiley. He said later that he knew the problem was completely solvable when it was confirmed to him that there was duct tape on the spacecraft. He says, "I felt like we were home free. One thing a Southern boy will never say is, I don't think duct tape will fix it."
No.
No, and duct tape was also used on the Apollo 17 mission when they damaged the fender on the lunar rover, so they were able to use duct tape to fix it. So it's interesting that, you know, that I mean, of two of the missions that were going to the moon, they needed to use the duct tape that they just happened to have stowed aboard on board. So I found it to be really cool.
Cool.
Yeah. What were you going to say before about duct tape? You were going to.
No, I said it is the magical tape that will fix everything, and you think it's the best tape in the world until you get on a film set and find gaffer's tape and
No.
realize
I've never been on a
that.
film set, so I couldn't tell you, but I will take your word for it on that one.
Yes, gaffer's tape is actually the tape is a thick type of cloth. That is even stronger than duct tape.
Oh, wow.
That they use for lighting rigs.
So you'd think that NASA would have adopted that. Especially for all these people who
it's
think they faked the moon landing, so they needed all the video equipment and the lighting equipment.
well, you also got to remember that the U.S. government does everything to the lowest bidder, and gaffer's tape is much more expensive than duct tape.
I'm sure they can find someone who can sell it. Who knows? And then Tony continues his journey, and he slides down the stairs. It's very cool. I've always loved the way that he does this. He does it very efficiently. You know, he just you know,
Yes.
puts his arms on the railings and slides all the way down. Now, I didn't count the number of stairs, but what I did notice was it's very interesting that this is like a metal staircase. You know, it doesn't it looks like it's, you know, it looks like they're in a submarine or something like that. You know, not something that you would find in an office building, even in the basement. But it works for the shot because the shot is great, how he slides down it. So,
Yeah. I mean, I could tell being in several office buildings in New York, or in America, that it's very utilitarian, that kind of stone-faced walls, there's not even paint on there.
right.
You're right. It is a metal staircase that he's going down.
And then the shot changes, and we see Tony walking down the corridor, and you know, he seems to as he's walking, you see him motion, and it looks like he's taking something out of his bag, which is great, the way that it's a very fluid shot. And then he passes a group of six like tubes that are on his left-hand side, and then he finds a way to skillfully glide over the railing onto the other side. You know, like he just Again, we mentioned you mentioned earlier that he must know all this stuff just by looking at schematics of the area, and he already knows where he needs to, like, I mean, again, we mentioned he's a dancer, so I guess he's good at doing these acrobatic moves to get over the,
Yes.
you know, get over the railing over there and stuff like that. But he does it very gracefully and nicely. So, and then, you know, the next shot we see that he has this what looks like an electric pizza cutter in his hand. You know,
Yeah, it's like a mini saw
yeah,
blade.
exactly. But I just found it really funny because it looks like a pizza cutter. You know, he's getting ready. He's down the basement. And he's like, all right, we want pizza. Who wants me to cut their pizza as quickly as possible? You know, which once again shows how organized they are. You know, they have everything detailed to the you know to the minute.
Yes.
No pun intended. like what we're doing. But still, you know, they know everything that they need, and you know, he just does it great. He as he's walking, he already takes out the, you know, the electric pizza cutter. I'm gonna keep calling it a pizza cutter, even though I know it's not. But you know, he skillfully just you know, takes out, and you know, it's obviously you know, mobile at this point. You know, it's cordless. He didn't need one with a cord. And then we see that he proceeds to open two of the cabinets that are marked on them Pacific Bell employees only.
The days of the bells.
Yes.
I'm guessing you have all research on the Bell Corporations
I
that were
do, I do, but I'm
basically.
not going to go into all of it. I'm just going to briefly say that so Pacific Bell was there were a group of different phone companies in the California area that merged in 1910. And at that point it was called the it was with AT&T and stuff like that. I mean it's interesting. I mean I did read the whole history of it, and it's interesting, but you know it's too much of a dive that we don't really need to get into it. But I mean they've changed the name of the company over the years. So, but between 1910 and 1984, it was known as the Pacific Telephone and Telegraph Company. And then in 1984, it actually was called Pacific Bell from 1984 till 2002. And then it.
And that was part of a nationwide monopoly that was
Yes,
broken up.
correct.
I could tell you, New York, the phone, and it was just the phone company. There was just one phone company that, and in New York, it was Bell Atlantic.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I lived in, I grew up in Detroit, you know, Michigan Bell. You know, and that's the way it was up until the 90s when, or actually, I think it was only in 2002 where they really broke them up. But you know, they did a nice job of it. Bell had a great monopoly, and it really worked, you know, for quite a long time. I mean, when they broke up AT&T in 1984, so AT&T held 89.8% of Pacific Telephone. You know, so they still owned a lot of it. So yeah, it's interesting. I mean, Pacific Bell will come up, you know, in a future season when I hopefully get to Die Hard 2, because you know, even though John's in Washington, we get to see a phone that says Pacific Bell on it. But we'll get there. Well, a teaser for a future season. You know, keep listening to so you'll be able
There you
to
go.
get there when we do that. And you know, as he after he opens up those cuts open those cabinets, he pulls out like a little valise, a metal case, you know, from his little bag, and he starts to sort through the various wires that have spilled out after opening up those cabinets. And that's pretty much how this minute ends. We'll have to see tomorrow what he actually does with all of these various, you know, cords that are coming around here. Did you have anything else you
Cool.
want to say about this particular minute before we move on to the script?
No, I think that covers it.
Right. All right. So the script again, this is, you know, to remind everyone, this isn't Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. We don't have an extra, you know, 2 hours and 12 minutes that are cut out of this the final script. But here we still have discrepancies. And the thing I love the most about the script is the way that they describe things. So this minute we actually mostly have descriptions, a few little minor discrepancies. So after it says Hans goes to the front door, waves the card over the magnetic plate, and an LED blinks and the door locks with a thud. Hans looks out into the street. Appropriately enough, not a creature is stirring. Century City is quiet. And then it says, quick cuts within the lobby. An elevator opens, revealing 10 more men, all armed with Kalashnikov machine guns, are carrying canvas kit bags. One of them, Eddie, a rugged American in his 20s, goes to the dead guard and immediately begins changing into his clothes. So I'm glad in the movie they decided to just have him change into the jacket. He doesn't need to take all the dead guy's clothes, you know. And then it says, meanwhile, Carl takes a tool case from the elevator and joins his brother Tony. First playfully grabbing him, they head for the basement stairwell. And then it says, Theo leaves the control room and nods to Hans. Eddie finishes adjusting buttons and snaps on his pilfered uniform, takes his position behind the front desk. So again, the one difference here, and we'll get to it later in the week, is that Carl is already with Tony at the beginning here. That's the big difference that I would find between these. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. So every Monday, we have a segment called Die Hard on a Monday, where my guest will actually tell us their top five Die Hard doppelganger movies. So we'll start with number five and work our way up. So what have you got for us, Eddie?
Okay. Well, real quick, I just wanted to say a quick honorable mention, because it's not a movie. It's a novel called Slayground by Donald Westlake. The pen name Richard Stark. It's one of the Parker novels. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Parker.
No. Oh wait. Oh, I am. That was. Yeah. What's his name? Did a Parker movie. Jason Statham.
Jason Statham.
Yes.
I
wasn't a fan of that movie. But I'm sure the book is.
No. But the character's been around since the early 60s. Actually, the movie Payback with Mel Gibson is probably, I would say, the best adaptation of the character. But he's a thief. He's a genius thief. Very much like I would say it's like Jack Reacher if he was a thief instead of a detective. The book Slayground that was published in 1971 has after he escapes a robbery, he hides out in an amusement park, and gangsters are surrounding the park, and it's kind of the cat and mouse game of him trying to get out of the amusement park without getting killed by the mobster.
Interesting.
Sounds very interesting. Yes, it was adapted into a movie in the early 80s with Peter Coyote, but they changed around the story a lot, and the amusement park angle is only like the last 10 minutes of that movie. But the novel is a lot of fun, and and even though it predates Die Hard, it has a lot of that same kind of intensity and suspense to it.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yes. For movies, I'm going to have a tie for fourth place, so four and five. I'm trying to do some stuff that, you know, I'm sure a lot of the same movies are probably going to be coming up in this segment. So I'm trying to do some stuff. I'm sure Speed and Under Siege are going to be mentioned a lot. So I'm going to say Speed 2 Cruise Control and Under Siege 2 Dark Territory, because they're not great movies. But I think they could have changed their franchises if they'd switched franchises. If you'd done Speed 2 on a train and Under Siege 2 on a cruise ship, I think that those could have been great movies, and those franchises could have gone on to third and fourth installments.
Okay, I can hear that. I think that if Under Siege would have been on a cruise ship, it wouldn't have been as good, because, you know, it's the idea of taking the same character and just putting him on another boat each time. You know, you mm-hmm. need to mix things up a little bit. I mean, with Speed, you know, you have the first one on the bus. Obviously, it's more than just the bus, but the main aspect of it is the bus. But to then put them on a train afterwards, maybe. Well, maybe. I hear what you're saying. I hear what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is when you think of Speed, you don't really think ocean liners.
Correct.
I think a runaway train could actually, you know, have more of a speed angle to
right.
it. For number three, I'm going to say The Equalizer with Denzel Washington, the third act of that is really just turns into Die Hard in a hardware store.
Okay.
It's very different, because John McClane is the type of hero where I think a lot of times you see his situations, you go, oh, I don't know, man. And a lot of these other movies, whereas a lot of other action heroes, it's more like you see them get into a scenario and go, oh, they don't know, man. They don't know what's coming.
Yeah, but John McClane always knows what's coming.
Equalizer is my number three. Number two, I'm going to say Dread. Which is the 2012 movie starring Carl Urban, the adaptation of the British comic character Judge Dredd. Mm-hmm. And it's Die Hard in a housing project with homicidal drug dealers.
Without Sylvester Stallone
Yes.
and Rob Schneider.
Yes. But just really, really, great intense close quarters action. And my number one is gonna be Get Off My Plane, Air Force One, starring Harrison Ford from 1997, which is Die Hard on Air Force One.
Yes, that is very good. Excellent. All right. Thank you for that. So, Eddie, you want to tell people how they can get in touch with you?
So I'm on Twitter at Lil Eddie O'Hare. I do have I'm not I'm I do have a podcast that I'm hoping to get off the ground by the end of the year. I don't want to tease too much about it, but
Yeah, well, if they follow you, they'll eventually figure it out. So that's good. That
I'm not on I haven't been posting on Twitter a lot in the last couple of years, just because I find staying away from social media has been good for my sanity. But I am hoping to be back on there soon.
Cool. Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter, or you can go to my website, which is movierobminute.com. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay!